Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Thanks for all coming. Good to see some familiar faces and welcome to new faces as well. And to say this is effectively part two. And it's interesting, in science, knowledge is cumulative, but in investing, it's cyclical. If we compounded the knowledge that took the man to the moon, arguably the FTSE would be at a trillion points rather than where it is at the moment. So hopefully with Swiss Army Knife Investing, I can enhance your knowledge even by a little bit today. To the man with only a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So if you can bring multiple tools to an investing party, hopefully we can deliver more superior returns. Best thing about doing these things is they've got some great new transitions now on PowerPoint. And this is my favorite. So I'm gonna start with retail and store rollouts. And I'm pretty wary of playing the retail store out rollout. They work really well at launch and growth mode, and you can see on the chart on the left, eventually you reach maturity and then you go into decline. And they work until they don't effectively. But a safer way to play the retail story is by investing in those that actually act their age. And when they reach that level of maturity, they grow old gracefully rather than disgracefully. But unfortunately, CEOs hate to admit that it's actually time to pause expansion and become more circumspect with their retail rollout story. But it is possible with the right strategy, if you can transition, rather than that maturity plateau to go into a decline, it is entirely possible to extend that maturity for several years thereafter. Unfortunately, the higher the PE rating going into that transition, though, the harder it becomes for a CEO to transition the model and also the strategy to cope with it. So the least successful retailers carry on opening stores well beyond the point at which they should have. The successful ones do curtail that expansion, but it does take a completely different skill set. And unfortunately, that transition between growth and maturity often isn't transferable. Is one example of this at the moment in real time, Domino's Pizza. They're carrying on opening new stores. They're calling it store splits. This is having the effect of upsetting their franchisees, which is never terribly clever when you're a franchisor. And arguably a better strategy for Domino's would be to pare back those openings rather than expanding into a town that already has one. Time will tell whether Domino's are in decline, but beyond a certain point, any additional incremental store that you open starts to destroy value for shareholders. So even though the top line is still going up, you can still destroy value. You might as well face it, you're addicted to growth. Management, what they should be looking at is concentrating very much on the return on invested capital for every new store that they open. That is the single best metric. The good retailers do track it and report on the cannibalization effect of opening new stores next to existing stores, but the offenders will very much try and point you towards earnings growth that each new store creates, and that's a bit of a head fake, which I'll come on to. There's actually a much stronger correlation in shareholder returns between slower store openings once you've reached this level of maturity. And you've got to understand the way markets work, there's a lot of cheerleaders. When you're going through this huge expansion and the growth and the brokers and your peers at exalted levels, everyone wants to keep the show on the road. Some of the weak at that point will turn to a Hail Mary acquisition. Perhaps Restaurant Group with Wagamama would fall into that. And the CEO worries at that point, up until that point, he or she has been banging the drum about growth, 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 growth. They worry that having then come to the market with a different message, that it's now much more about maturity, they panic about that and often they can't do it, they can't transition. Those that don't enter a long period of denial and atrophy can set in to a share price. So this shows you the difference between below average retailers in orange and above average retailers in blue. You can see the store count was a lot slower with the above average retailers. Like for likes were better, revenue, in terms of overall revenue, is pretty similar to the ones that carried on opening stores at a quicker pace. But the expenses, if you can see, the expenses are 4.3%. This is annual growth between 2011 and 15 on this study by Marshall Fisher. 4.3% compound growth in expenses plays 4.7% growth in revenues. That's for the mature stores. Whereas the below average retailers were growing at 4.6% on the top line, but at their expenses was marginally above that, growing at a quicker pace. And it's only tiny, tiny differences that can add up to quite a lot. And that tiny difference, it reminds me of the quote from David Copperfield and Mr. Micawber: annual income £20, annual expenditure 19, 19 and 6, result happiness. Annual income £20, annual expenditure 20, naught and 6, result misery. And that's the difference fine margins make. And you compare that to the operating profit, the above average retailers who were slower growing their store estate delivered 8% compound growth in operating profit. Whereas those that still had the foot down on store expansion only grew their operating profits 0.9%. So you can see that even mid to low single digit growth can deliver strong returns. And I'm going to turn to a case study now. This is Shoe Zone. I've held this in the AIM IHT portfolio for a good number of years. It's the only retailer I've had in my strategy. This is an even more extreme example. This isn't low growth, this is actually negative growth. So that's its revenues since 2012. Doesn't look too clever. And that's great for me, because if you go under the bonnet and you know what's going on within that mix, it gives you a really good opportunity. The quant to look at that and move on in no time, because the thing that's in structural decline. And normally, if top line sales are falling to that degree, you don't want to touch it with a barge pole. But what was going on underneath the bonnet? Fabulously run business, owner managed, they own over 50% of the shares, the family. What they've been doing is exiting marginal stores at the end of their lease and improving the overall quality of their estate. Their best performing store, incidentally, is the ones that are located next to Primark. So in one town, Primark shifted its store to another part of town and the sales collapsed in Shoe Zone. Only had 9 months left of its lease, relocated back to Primark, and it's the best performing store yet again. Retail is very much can be location, location, location. The market, though, is obsessed with growth, and they can react badly, though, if you're going to change your strategy. But the sales were falling, but then if we overlay on top of that operating profits, you can see that actually operating profits have risen over that same period of time, and they came in at a record operating profit. So despite much lower sales, operating profit has gone up. The return on capital employed from Shoe Zone is typically 20-25% in that sort of range. And what turned me onto them initially was, first and foremost, they were world-class property managers. That's very important. Retail is very much a commodity play. You buy a pair of trousers from China and you put a markup on it and sell it in the UK. They were very exceptional with their lease length and the management of it. Their average lease length was only 2 years. Upon renewal, their rent reduction was coming in at 20-23%, £400,000 a year benefit to them. During that time, they've also increasingly sourced direct from Chinese manufacturers. So the shoes, 85%, they buy direct now. They've cut out the middleman, they've captured that margin, and they've reinvested that back into their value proposition. They've got a laser-like focus on their value proposition. And their digital strategy has been a bit of an afterthought until the last couple of years, and now it is very much joined up and front and center. Their returns rate on their online is only 11%, which is class leading anyway. And of those that are returned, 90% are returned to their stores. This is why I think the genuine best retailers need an estate. This is 500 stores nationwide. You need that density of the estate. And of that 90%, if they return it to store, you can bet your bottom dollar they're going to exchange it for another pair of shoes. So it's actually wonderful. And they can deliver a pair of shoes for £10 to you with free postage. And they actually make more profit from a £10 online sale with free postage to you than they do selling that same pair of shoes in store. Remarkable. Add it all up, and that's the total return since it listed, 83%. Handily outperformed the FTSE All Share, 31% total return. And general retail sector has fallen 10%. So despite sales falling at Shoe Zone, that doesn't translate and necessarily correlate into negative shareholder returns. In fact, quite the opposite. The majority can't lever once they've gone on this growth addiction. They can't lever to maturity. Often it takes a change of CEO. You need to be open with your investors, though, and as long as you foretell it with enough time and be conservative with your sales targets and have a laser-like focus on your return on capital, you can deliver very strong returns. Because when a retailer reached maturity and stopped opening as many stores, they turn into cash machines. The great thing about the founder-run business of Shoe Zone, capital allocation is at the forefront. Anything above £11 million net cash on the balance sheet, which they don't need, they give back to us as shareholders in ordinary dividend and special dividends. So since they've listed, they've actually returned over 40% of the original IPO price in dividends. It's a cash machine, and I think it's going to remain so. You add in, there's a new growth element coming through now. They're actually moving into big boxes on retail parks. It's a slightly different customer demographic. They're selling Skechers and Clarks and Hush Puppies and Wrangler. Slightly bigger ticket. They're going to have 45 big box stores now by the end of December. And the great thing about a retailer, if you've got a nationwide store estate, you can trial new initiatives and quietly bury the ones that don't work. The ones that do work, run with them and actually expand and roll them out. The payback on these big boxes is less than 12 months for Shoe Zone. And what I love about this and the company, they're always trying to bear down on costs wherever possible. And if you see the square at the bottom on the right, they redesigned it themselves. They do it a bit like the Galapagos Islands. Everything's evolved internally on their own. They've got their own IT system. They redesigned the racking for the shoes themselves, and they're saving £50,000 now for every new big box. And they love that, and I love that as well. They can reinvest those savings in other parts of the business. Arguably, there's a new growth angle coming to Shoe Zone. They're on 12 times forward earnings at the moment. That's a discount to peers that aren't acting their age or with the same level of maturity. Arguably, you should be assigning more of a growth rating going forward to Shoe Zone, and I think the market will. Want to move on to buy and build now. This is an area that I need to get better at myself, and this is a great thing about doing presentations. It forces you to write your thoughts down, and you learn from that. So buy and build works wonderfully well when it's executed. What you're trying to do is take advantage of the market's proclivity of assigning bigger companies a bigger rating. So this shows you the median EBITDA purchase multiple paid, depending on deal size. So the darker are deal sizes, the darkest is over $2.5 billion deal size, and then it goes down. So you can see the lightest one on the left, they would enterprise values are less than $25 million. So there's a strong correlation between the size of your EBITDA, your earnings, and what multiple someone's prepared to pay for that. And that's what buy and build does in terms of alchemy. It's multiple arbitrage. You're buying something that's small for a low rating, you're landing it onto your business that's bigger, and you get a bigger rating on top of that. And it's as simple as that. But there are certain patterns to success when it comes to successful buy and build. Critical that the company, that platform company that you're using to land your acquisitions on, generates enough free cash flow to stand on its own feet and finance deals. Now, the market is very forgiving when it comes to cash flow, particularly when you're buying it in the early days and everyone's very excited and the virtuous circle's kicking in. But at some point, you'll hit a hiccup, your net debt EBITDA is too big, your equity's crashed, and you can't raise any money to do more deals. At that point, it's very much critical that this thing that you've cobbled together is generating enough free cash flow. Also look at sectors in terms of the cyclicality, what disruption's going on there, what's the concentration of the suppliers and customers. All of them can disrupt your cash flows. Nearly every buy and build strategy relies upon scale advantages and the scale effects. The bigger you get, the more purchasing power you've got and more market power you've got. If your customers and suppliers are engaging in a similar strategy and they're consolidating and beefing up, that can negate some of your benefits. So look at that as well. And the best sectors are those where the inherent organic growth. That's why I think Keywords has done as well as it has done. I'm going through Theresa May, excuse me. Organic growth means that you're not dependent upon taking market share. So your market share stays static, but if the market has grown 7%, then your sales will go 7%. It helps you get out of trouble. It's a rising tide. Why Keyword Studios has done so well, which is a buy and build model, I think that's a key reason, because there's organic growth inherent within the model. That and a strong culture, and going up to a PE of 50 or 60 times didn't hurt them either. So what we also want with buy and build is what we call lots of white space. What's the supply of these businesses on offer? Are founders retiring? Are the regulatory drivers forcing them out? Is it hard to remain independent? What's the demand like? How much are you competing with other strategic buyers? And is there enough runway to engage in meaningful buy and build? What you don't want is 1 or 2 years worth of opportunity and it's gone. What you want is to be able to do this for multiple years. So the runway, it's no good if there's too little supply and too much demand, because that'll quickly drive up prices and extinguish this multiple arbitrage which you're trying to capture. And the other pattern success, M&A is very, 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 very hard to do, even small deals. You look at Ideagen, who are an exemplar in how to execute it. The dossier that they prepare is ferocious. The amount of due diligence questions they have to go through, and then the integration team's very much on board early. It's very, very hard to do. Back experience. If someone's trying to come out with a strategy and they've never done a deal before in their life, avoid them. You need to take your licks. You need to learn from your mistakes. So only back those that have trodden this path before. The platform business you're landing onto needs to be joined up as well and robust. The IT system needs to be whole. It can't be spaghetti IT. If you're buying all sorts of businesses with their own software operating systems, it becomes a mess. You want a strong balance sheet as well. The amount of times that I buy and build founders because their balance sheet was a mess is uncanny. I get nervous at net debt at EBITDA above 2x, get very, very nervous then, because there's just less margin for error. Hiccups happen all the time with companies. And what you want is a repeatable, codified way of folding these in and rejigging their financial and operational models to yours. And you want it to be able to scale, your sales and distribution to scale. Otherwise, what will happen is your revenues go up, but your operating margins will be falling. And watch out for realization of cost, because that's a key part of the value generation. And that's indicating that they're properly integrating these businesses. And the cash flow, again, it does get tricky with buy and build, because you can game the cash flow. A very clever, nefarious CFO, if they wanted to pull the wool over your eyes, they're going to be able to, because there's all sorts of acquisition accounting that makes it very, very hard to look through. And the other key is don't stray from your core. If you've got a good business and you want to engage in buy and build, that's great, but stick to the core. Basically, the further an acquirer strays from its core into adjacent markets, the greater the chance of something going wrong. It may be astute, but it often isn't. Restore Group, company I used to own, document management, great business, get a box of paper, stick it in the ground for 15 years and keep rising the price every year that you've got it for. Started to move into scanning and shredding and office relocation and toner recycling, which just exited now again. They're kind of me too businesses. Where's the margin? Where's the barriers to entry in that? I question moving into those adjacencies. And then you've got the denouement with buy and build. Eventually, the consolidators pick off all the attractive mid-market acquisitions. Those that remain have been bid up to such an extent that the game should be over, and that multiple arbitrage where you're buying something on 5x and you're trading at 12x, that's gone. Because if you're buying something at the same as you, that multiple arbitrage is just gone, or should be. That's why I've gone slightly berserk with my highlighter pen, because that's what should be, but often it doesn't happen. It's because this gravy train is going, everyone thinks they're a hero, and they start believing their own hype, and it's very, very hard to have that capital discipline not to carry on going past the point of no return. That's why it's no accident that Judge's Scientific share price has done as well as it has done. I think their maximum they pay is 6x EV, but they're ridiculously disciplined on that. So what's left at this point, it's either too small or too large for you. The sector has what we call barbelled, and that's when it should be over, and then you just run these things for cash instead. To butcher the aphorism, price is what you pay, value is what you don't get. So these are key takeaways if you're looking at companies engaging in buy and build. They should only be paying for small businesses 3x to 5x EV EBITDA. That's equivalent to a 33-20% return on investment. I get very antsy above 7x. That's a ceiling for me, 14% ROI. Beyond that, if you're paying higher multiples than 7, you're starting to corrupt the model. And if you start seeing the word strategic attached to an acquisition, it often means they've just overpaid for it. Sometimes you'll see double digit
EV, EBITDA multiples, and then you're going to be in a world of pain because 11 times is only equivalent to 9 times ROI. You're diluting the returns with the bigger acquisitions you do. And if you're starting to see synergies being banded out to try and justify a frothy share price, any spreadsheet junkie can reverse engineer revenue and cost synergies to justify any price, but they are hard to achieve. So take them with a massive pinch of salt. What you should do, the best, are actually very conservative with their cost savings. They understate them in day one because they're keeping it back in reserve because they want to over-deliver, under-promise, over-deliver. They'll upgrade down the line. If they're having to justify saying we're paying 11.5, but actually X synergy, we're paying 8.5, so don't worry about it. Be very, very careful. So let's use Restore as an example. In the early days, they were only paying less than 6 times and the deals were less than £2 million. Then we started to go up 23 mil. That was Cintas, and that looks like an aberration. There was a one-off why the multiple was so high. But if you look at the sales ratio, 1.2, that was still reasonable. Then we had Wincanton acquisition from them. Enterprise value is 60 million. EV EBITDA was nearly 9 times at this point. Then you had PHS, 9.8 times multiple. Then you had TNT, 11.4 times. So you can see the bigger these deals got, the higher the multiple Restore was paying. And I hopped off after the Wincanton acquisition. Not too clever because they doubled in price thereafter or something like that. But I was no longer comfortable with where they were going with this buy and build story. So what happened then? Well, there was a bit of Q4 madness within this. But the CMA, the Competition Authority, reviewed the TNT deal. And I'll come back to that. CEO exercised 600,000 nil share options, sold them immediately. And don't get me going on nil priced options. I think that should be illegal expropriation of assets, essentially. Data shred margin, they warned on that. That's one of the adjacent businesses. Net box growth was flat, which was a bit scary. The CEO then announced he was leaving after 10 years. And that's valuable information. When someone's been there that long, they obviously want to go out somewhere near a high and leave a legacy. Unfortunately, he left it a bit late. And there was a lot of damage done by the time he announced he was leaving. I think he's left for a reason. And then the CFO shortly thereafter has announced he's leaving as well. Then you've had a 5% earnings downgrade, a bit of a confluence of events. For that TNT acquisition, they raised £51 million in the market and the share price at the time was £4.72 and they raised at £5.10. Giddiness, take that as a bear signal. The fact that people are paying more than the market price to get into this, they're desperate to get into it. How many more bulls are there left to get into this story, especially after a multi-year story and especially at paying that price? I take that as a negative. Iron Mountain, which is the number one in the market, has warned recently that this industry may now actually be X growth. Digitization is increasingly eating into this industry. Rather than sticking a box of papers in the ground, you're scanning them and holding them in the cloud. And GDPR has refocused minds as well. We'll see. The white space is gone though for Restore. They've bought all that mid space that they can do. White space is gone. I think they should turn into a REIT like Iron Mountain is a REIT and just run it and pay a high dividend at this point. We will see. The CEO leaving now, he's going to be entirely responsible for the next 2 years of trading. And that's also something to look for. Just because he's left, what goes thereafter is still his strategy. And I do look at that. What we've also had then in this period is the forward PE rating has derated fairly meaningfully. High PE companies have a pernicious effect on CEOs. They're desperate to keep the valuation high and it can encourage more M&A than is prudent. Also, when you're acquiring, you sugar rush your organic growth. You acquire a company, take their product and stuff it through your distribution channels, and you get a one-off big jump in their sales, which looks like organic growth, but that's one-off. Then you have to keep doing acquisitions to keep this one-off organic growth, make it look sustainable. The problem is when you stop doing acquisitions, the tide starts to go out, to use a Buffettism, and now we're going to see who's swimming naked with a full body wax. I think Restore is there. This is not a new chapter in Restore. This is a new film. Avoid these situations. Don't think these are a bargain because they've fallen 50%. This is stale bread. It should be cheaper. It's a brand new film. It's not a new chapter. What's going to happen now is because there's no more white space left and acquisitions are over, the CMA reviewed that deal and they've told them essentially there's no more consolidation to do. The top three they're a bit late to the party. The top three already control 65% of the document storage warehouse. It's an oligopoly already. So they can't do any more deals. So we're going to see what the true organic growth rate. If they've gone X growth, then even a P of 12.5 is too high and their earnings growth is too high. And often a better way of playing buy and build is when a new CEO comes in and the CFO, kitchen sinks, the goodwill is going to have to be written down. They're a huge percent of total assets. Net debt can be a problem. Do an equity refinance, you're going to smash your PE. Then have a look at it. Then they become interesting again. Sunlight is the best bleach. A key part of this as well is earnings accretion. You'll see this mentioned and quoted every time a deal is done, and to evaluate and justify a deal, it's earnings enhancing. I think that's keeping the wrong score. Earnings enhancing deals can be value destructive. The first line of Restore's results, and I'm not picking on Restore, really not. The first line of their full year Restore results reference their ninth consecutive year of double digit earnings growth. Two of the biggest myths in the stock market are earnings accretive deals add value and earnings dilutive deals destroy value. They absolutely don't. Give you a simplified example, how something can be earnings accretive but value destructive. This is very simplified deliberately. That's supposed to be a flake, by the way. That took me an hour to create that. So Stevie Arno ice cream bought for £500,000. That was a 10 times multiple. We used excess cash, so it's earnings accretive because the cash was earning buttons at the moment. And we're earning £50,000 a year now, lots of lolly. Thank you. Then you had to capitalize £450,000 of goodwill because the van was only worth £50,000 in terms of the net asset value. But we're earnings enhancing from year one. All is good. Unfortunately, things didn't work out owing to turf wars, inclement weather, a knackered engine and emission zone charging. The outlook has deteriorated and we're booking a non-cash impairment charge of £450,000. You've destroyed £350,000 of value. So that's why don't conflate earnings accretion with value accretion. You've got to try very hard not to add value if you're buying something at 3 to 5 times EV EBITDA. You've got to try even harder to generate value if you're paying more than 7 times. And that's the worry now with Restore. That's my favorite one, I think. Yeah, that's the last of them. So I'll give you some other tools. These are the ones that I hardly ever know. I don't even know what they do on the Swiss Army knife, but hopefully these are more useful to you. Gartner's hype cycle. This is an example of Amara's law. Roy Amara coined the phrase, we tend to overestimate the effect that technology has in the short term and underestimate the effect in the long term. So what you have is this disruption comes in and the hype kicks in, you have inflated expectations, and then it never quite works out that way. There's no harm in trading that bubble. If you're going to do it though, please do a picks and shovels type approach. You're having more shots at goal then rather than trying to identify winners. So graphene you can probably put into this chart. When you've troughed, then have a look at them in terms of the trough of disillusionment. What's left standing arguably has some value to it then. And that's a much safer point if you're going to buy emerging technological companies. If we overlay Amazon, this is Amazon's share price in 2001. Bottomed at $6, trough of disillusionment, still standing though, and then it went up to $60 in 2 years. If you sold, you've been crying thereafter because, of course, it's $2,000 now. But it's often safer to look at it then. And another takeaway from technical disruption, it's often easier to spot the losers than it is the winners. When the motor car came around, as Warren Buffett said, there were 20 million horses in the US in 1900. Today, there's 4 million horses. Short the horse. There was 2,000 automobile manufacturing companies back in the day. Good luck trying to spot the winners from 2,000 automobile manufacturers. You couldn't. So wait, bide your time, and it's often easier. A free cash flow cycle. This is a highly stylized example. This is Warrington PLC, which is my hometown. The shaded area, free cash flow. This is when companies engage in big CapEx programs, and especially the bigger the CapEx and the longer it's going to take, often you start to drag a share price down. And that's perverse because what you're actually doing is a long-term positive is being viewed as a short-term negative. If you feel that this CapEx is going to generate meaningful returns in the future, well, point A is a far better point to start thinking about these things.
Point A, we're starting to inflect, and we've got an indication now that our CapEx program has reached its apogee and we're starting to reduce CapEx. If you want to de-risk it even more, wait until free cash flow goes back positive again. That's a very, very good trade. What you've done is you've got a far stronger business now, as long as the CapEx has been spent wisely. And it's a better entry point as well. You see it time and time again, especially if something in the payoff's not going to happen for 18 to 24 months. Stock market doesn't really give a fig about anything that's going to happen in 24 months. More and more so that our advantage is arbitraging time, just getting involved and sitting with it and arbitraging that time, and it'll come through. Another little tool that's handy is on cyclicals. Forward PE is very, very insightful. It can just add more color to a share price increase. This is Virtue Motors, one that I used to hold. CFO came around in 2011, started telling me about PCPs. I'd never heard of PCPs up until that point. I thought they were wonderful. This is going to be great for the share price, to simplify. And it was. But you can see what happened here. The forward PE rating got up to 16 times at the end of 2013. Then it got up, the share price made a new high at the top, got to 80 pence. But look what's happened to the forward PE. If you can get this data, there must be packages out there, please do look at it. It just gives you another lens on how to look at things. Now, the forward PE was actually making a lower high. The forward PE at that point was only 14 times. And this is exactly what should happen. The market is superb at getting these right. This is your early warning sign. I was hearing at the time, analysts were waxing lyrical about Virtue only being on a forward PE of 14, and that's good value. As soon as you hear anyone describing a cyclical as good value because it's on a low PE, run for the hills. What you want to buy a cyclical on is a ridiculously high PE because the earnings are buttons and collapsed, and you want to sell them on a low PE. So this was great, and then the share price shortly collapsed 50% on Virtue. I'm not touching them at the moment. I think there's just not enough visibility in the whole sector with what's going on. Rumsfeldian investing, known unknowns and all that jargon. These can be very profitable as well. This is Augean. They were hit by a HMRC tax bill, which was unquantified at that point. Now, there's a behavioral aspect here. Without getting too granular on it, it's the stock market regularly serves up positive expected value bets. There's a high probability of a small loss and a low probability of a big gain. They're wonderful if they've got an expected value. So a lottery ticket's got a negative expected value. You buy loads of them, you're going to lose money. But expected value bets, you do them every time, but you have to keep buying them. This is the fear of looking like a fool effect. The fund manager is answerable to its client. The client knows that they've been hit by a tax bill. If it comes in fairly big, how on earth are you going to explain that to your client? Better to sell, irregardless of the price. Just sell, just get out. I don't care. And that's why you overshoot with a known unknown negative event. Very often there's rich pickings to be had. Now, you had some exceptional new management come in, which did some other things and disposals as well, but the share price from 20 pence now up to 117. And the biggest known unknown at the moment for us as investors is Brexit. That's why I've now tilted my portfolio 66% to UK sales. I was underweight UK sales previously. I just think it's too far. It's a known unknown. We've seen we're massively under-owned by foreign investors. There's a lot of weight of money effect to come back into the UK market if you get any semblance of clarity on Brexit. So these are wonderful asymmetric payoffs. Also, sometimes it's what you don't see that gives the game away in investing. This is the dog that didn't bark, Silver Blaze. Sherlock Holmes, my favorite book. Wonderful stories. So this was the horse, he was nicked, and the inspector, any other point you wish to draw my attention to, Sherlock? The curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. He did nothing in the nighttime, and that was the curious incident. The dog didn't bark because it was the trainer who nicked the horse, so the dog knew the trainer, and that's what cracked the case for Holmes, because something didn't happen. And that's the story in investment. It's what you're not seeing. So are you not seeing a strong culture? This was an analyst at Deutsche Bank chastising the CEO for paying the workers too much. You need to think about your shareholders first. The riposte to that, he said, the last thing I want you to believe is I don't care about the shareholders, but if you reward employees and all stakeholders, that's going to deliver the best returns. And then we fast forward, well, that's what Costco's done relative to Walmart, who pays pittance, relative to Costco and Target, which is even worse. It's trumped them. So what's supposedly a negative, but this is because they've got a very, very strong culture. And increasingly, with automation going on, with algorithms, anything that can be automated will be automated on the quantitative side. Culture is very qualitative. If you can get a handle of a good culture, and I don't see it talked about enough in company results, then you are onto something that can deliver meaningful returns. A hat tip to Marla at FinCap. I was asking for an example on this one. And any loss-making business, what's better for them to do, and this was STV in 2007, they explicitly laid out 12 KPIs and they reported on them at their interims and finals. So you can judge them on their progress on their KPIs. That's what you should be doing if you're loss-making, because you do need some yardstick, and that gives you credibility with investors and you get the benefit of the doubt much more rather than trying to obfuscate and pull the wool over their eyes. So that's another thing to look for. If it's loss-making, ask them why they don't have KPIs for you to track them. This one is more for the traders. It's a bit of fun. I am claiming this video stamped. I'm going to call this English pivot points because I haven't seen this anywhere else. Unfortunately, I thought I found the Holy Grail here and I thought this was it. I haven't been able to make any money out of this. But just to make you aware, dirty little secret is I spend an inordinate amount of time looking at charts. There are regular patterns that happen. Human nature is always going to be human nature, and how we react to negative events is always going to be similar. What I found is a peak to trough drawdown of 66% can often lead to a 50% bounce. So that's animal care, down 66%, bounce 50. The next level is 74, 75% is normally a good pivot point. Say this is just for trading, bit of fun. If you can make money out of this, please email me and we'll keep it between ourselves. I've tried to finesse the entry point, but just to make you aware, sometimes a share price just goes up for other reasons besides fundamentals. That's Augean, 66%, look where it bottomed. That's Dignity, 74%, rallied 77%, didn't quite go to 80. CVS Group, 75%, that's when it bounced 80%. Learning Technology, 64%, and that's the problem, because sometimes they turn on a sixpence at 64% retracement, other times it's 66%. And even Bitcoin, down 66%, that was the good entry point to get in. So just for traders. This is probably the three eyes, probably the biggest thing I look for now. The more you get in an investing game, the more simple you like to keep things. Simplicity is complexity resolved. Integrity, incentives, and intelligence. And I would put integrity and incentives miles and miles ahead of intelligence of a CEO. They're the raw ingredients, they're the foodstuff. Then if you can ally to that superior capital allocation, you will get long-term outperformance. Unfortunately, believe it or not, a lot of CEOs don't understand how the stock market works, especially when it comes to buyback, which is a big bugbear of mine. I wish they would do a lot more buybacks and be more aggressive in the market, especially the way liquidity is going. To have that buyer of last resort can encourage some people to buy your shares that wouldn't ordinarily, because they know there's a backstop there. I had a frosty exchange with a CFO. Thankfully, it was towards the end of the call. And she said, we're too busy concentrating on running our business, which missed the point spectacularly, and it's unfortunate. What you're trying to find are people who are outstanding in their field. Where you kind of differentiate, are they just outstanding in their field? And this is Jethro. If you Google Jethro outstanding in his field, and it's a wonderful sketch. There's a few colorful language at the end, but it said in the paper that you can be an OBE if you're outstanding in your field. And apologies to the Cornish contingent for that accent. But all you need to do is get very, very good at recognizing excellent. Be excellent at recognizing excellence. You don't have to be excellent yourself necessarily. Also, the great thing about investing is you don't have to come up with the original idea. You just have to be able to spot what a good original idea is and which ones to reject. Build your community. That's the great thing about Mellow. It's like Woodstock. Align yourself with good people. And I always like to finish up on a slide with essential reading. These are the books that have made me a little bit better as an investor. Theranos Bad Blood reads like a thriller. Malfeasance by the CEO, incredible. Shoe Dog, the Nike founder, best quote in the book. Apparently, we walk the equivalent in our lifetime 6 times around the world. He had a laser-like focus on athletes. He had this insurgent attitude, and it was their mission to do the best for their athletes. And it became almost a religion, a zeal that they had amongst their employees. The other thing I like about that is Dimension 6 was the name that he wanted to name Nike. Dimension 6. He didn't have a clue. They had a deadline. So one guy had a dream and it came to him in a dream, Nike. So they went with that. And the woman who came up with the swoosh got paid £25. And then the other 100 baggers, it's humbling that in your investing lifetime, four or five stocks could dictate the majority of your career as an investor. You buy them right and hold them tight. That codifies what attributes to look for stocks that have the propensity to go up 100-fold. Keep hold of them over 10, 20 years, and you're going to do very, very well. And I'm leaving you out with the last quote from 100 Baggers, which I think is a wonderful quote, and it's how I approach investing from a philosophical perspective. The price of a stock varies inversely with the thickness of its research file. The simpler the proposition, often the stronger the case. If your file is that thick to trying to justify an investment, move on. And that is me done. No, thank you very much. Stunned silence. That's what I like.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information only. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.